Hello, I'm Renee Vaughan Sutherland, and welcome to Greater Than 11%, a weekly podcast that explores roles and opportunities within the creative industries, with the aim of contributing to increasing diversity across the board, in addition to promoting some awesome women. Episode 49, I'm joined by Strategy and Operations Manager Crystal Eisinger. On finishing her International Baccalaureate, Crystal opted for a gap year. She applied to the Deloitte Scholar Scheme, which involved a year's work experience before university, plus a series of placements while studying. After her year in the industry, she went to the University of Cambridge and did an undergraduate degree in History and Politics, going on to complete a Master's in Philosophy. On graduation, she was recruited by Deloitte to initially work on a project with one of Australia's leading retailers as a consultant, focusing on strategy, intelligent merchandising, and supply chain. Leaving Deloitte, she moved to OurPath as their head of marketing, a health tech startup providing at-risk people with an online program to help change their lifestyle. Following this, she stepped into a strategy lead role with Google's DoubleClick, which focuses on connecting brands and people. Crystal then progressed within the tech giant to become a UK strategy and operations lead, as well as focusing on customer centricity for the UK and Ireland, where she's responsible for a £1 billion segment of the organisation's business. Her role includes, but is by no means limited to, business planning, customer segmentation, organisational change, sales activation, and marketing strategy. In 2018, she was part of the Marketing Academy, a scholarship awarded to only 30 people a year across the UK. And she's also on the Marketing Week's Founding 50, a group of marketeers under 30 who are working to change the perception of marketing and promoting it as a viable career path for young people across the UK. Crystal is also one of Management Today's 2019's 35 under 35 Rising Business Women, and she was also awarded Wacol's Future Leader Award this year. She's a passionate supporter, mentor, and coach of women, focusing on helping them succeed in the workplace. Crystal, this intro is epic. Welcome to Greater Than 11%.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm wondering if you can start by telling me what your role as a strategy and operations lead does.
No, I can't give you a good answer to that because it changes all the time. I actually hate the concept of strategy and operations. I think it's quite ivory tower-esque in the way that it's positioned within businesses. But the way that I think about it, and there'll be lots of different flavours, is I think about it as behaviour change. So when I think about strategy and operations, the core role is really using data, market intelligence, and the insights of brilliant people within the organisation and our customers to define what the right thing to do is for the business and how to help us grow. The next bit is then working out how you do that, and that's a bit that I find really interesting. And in my current role, that is influencing about 500 salespeople across three sites, London, Dublin and Hyderabad, to think differently about how they go about selling and partnering with our customers, which is really around understanding people and what motivates them and giving them a really good reason to change the way that they're doing something. So that's what my flavour of strategy and operations is, but I'm sure that's different to many others.
So could you give us maybe a bit of an example of something so that we can like flesh it out and like understand it in practical terms?
Yes, absolutely. So one hat that I wear is, as you mentioned, being the business partner to a $1 billion segment of the Google Ads business in the UK. What this means is that I'm responsible for making sure that our customers are really happy and they're getting great results from our digital advertising solutions, and also that we're hitting our numbers, that our people are happy, and all of that falls within my responsibility. So on one occasion, it might be looking at our metrics, which show how well people are using our products and whether they could be using them better, and thinking about strategies for how can we communicate the benefits of doing something in a different way to them, in a way that resonates with them better. Another version of it might be a new product has launched internally and I need to think about how to position this so that our salespeople can go out and talk to our customers about it in a way that means something to them as opposed to in a very general sense. So I would say that a core skill really around it is just translating things. And one day it will be looking at how to run the business from a metrics perspective. Other days it will be looking at behaviours. Another day it will be looking at our culture and what are we doing enough to make sure that there's a good culture of sharing within the organisation, for example. The second hat that I wear is for something called customer centricity within the UK and Ireland business. So every year we survey all of our customers to ask them how satisfied they are with us as a partner. And I would say that I'm ultimately responsible for improving those numbers year on year. That sits across a large number of behaviour change activities and programmes across London, Dublin and Hyderabad. And really that's understanding what our customers are valuing that they're doing, what they'd like us to see more of, and then how do I enable our sales force to be the partners that our customers want them to be.
Sounds super busy.
It is busy, yeah. But it's such an amazing opportunity because the way that I think about it is people at Google are so smart and mm-hmm. so intelligent and so motivated mm-hmm. and they want to do the right thing. Yeah. So if I can then prompt them to think about something in a different way, get them to prepare for something in a way they might not have thought of doing, then for me that's a success and it's also a great challenge.
Yeah, and must feel great when you can land that as well.
Yeah, it is great and it's also really complicated, right? Part of the reason I think strategy and operations is a bit of a horrible title is because there's this sense that, you know, you're the consultant coming in telling people how to do their job. Mm. And there's such a delicate balance to be sought between never being patronising, always assuming that the people that you're talking to know the best thing for their customers, and then still being helpful and enabling them. And that's why I think that the communications and the how and giving people a really strong reason to believe and articulating a positive vision for the future that is created through that change mm-hmm. is so powerful. Because just telling people to do something when they're already smart, they're never going to change.
And is there a typical day for you?
The one thing that unites every day is the pace within the organisation and the amazing people and the motivation to do things that are going to drive growth in some way, whether that's for our customers or for us as a business or for Googlers. Mm-hmm. The reality of the day is that there are lots of meetings, but I'm trying to get better at hacking my calendar and spending more time in deep thought. The Google working environment is hyper flexible and really will swarm around the kind of key issues at the time. So no, sorry, that's a terrible answer, but there is no typical day.
Okay. So I'm wondering if you can talk about all these amazing things that you've already done and achieved and give us a bit of a kind of backstory. So that whole starting out and taking a gap year and thinking about what you wanted to do.
My first entry into the corporate world in general was actually when I was, I think, about 16, and it came about as one of those kind of career evenings. And my mum actually forced me to go and speak to another parent who was a partner at Deloitte at the time. Mm-hmm. And I was so uninterested in this. Yeah. And I kind of dragged my feet off and went and spoke to her. She said, oh, you can come in for work experience for a couple of weeks. And I didn't want to do it. But I went in mm-hmm. and did a couple of weeks of work experience at Deloitte, age 16. And I found it quite interesting. I wouldn't say I was like super enthralled at that point.
Did you have any idea before this point what you wanted to do? Or
you know, I think about this a lot. And for a really long time, I wanted to be a barrister. Okay. And I remember another parent came in who was a barrister and spoke to us and said, well, to be a barrister, you have to get this many A-stars at GCSE, and then you have to get this in your A-level results, and then you have to go to Oxford or Cambridge, and then you have to be in the top 10% of your class to get a mini pupillage. And weirdly, I then just was completely turned off that because I was like, I'm never going to meet all of those gating criteria. Mm-hmm. And almost in one fell swoop, it completely quashed my dreams of, not dreams of doing it, but I was just like, statistically, that's never going to happen. Yeah. I'm not going to do all of those things to get to that point.
Oh my God, you were already thinking about statistics at that.
Yeah. And so I kind of pivoted away from that. I was like, no, I think about law as a career. And I do think that you have to be prepared to not get financial reward immediately. There's quite a lot of risk involved. Mm. You know, there's a reason why people from particular backgrounds, I think, tend to go into that as a career, particularly being a barrister rather than a solicitor, because it's risky. Anyway, I took that far too much to heart and I decided not to pursue it. Okay. The story behind the Deloitte gap year, actually, I applied to Oxford for PPE and I got rejected. And at that time, at that tender age, it felt like it was the end of my life. And I have such a vivid memory of spending New Year's, whichever year it was, kind of sobbing into my pillow, being like, my life is over, I didn't get into Oxford. Obviously, this sounds awful.
Not really. There's a huge pressure at that age. Yeah. And if you've really focused and worked hard, why wouldn't you cry?
Yeah, there was a huge pressure and I thought that was it, basically. Mm. In tandem to applying to Oxford, which was a really horrible process. I think about it then and none of it actually felt authentic or true to who I was in that. I don't think I properly considered what I was applying for or even thought about it. So in a way, it was kind of fated from the start. Mm-hmm. But in tandem to applying to Oxford, I applied to the Deloitte Scholar Scheme because I'd done this 2 weeks of gap year. I didn't really think about it too much. It was kind of my backup option. And then it ended up being the best thing I've ever done in my entire life. And the Deloitte Scholar Scheme was a 9-month gap year placement where you were paid, treated exactly the same as a university grad mm-hmm. at the age of 18, paid during your university time to go and work for them during the holidays. You mm-hmm. also got paid to go traveling during your gap year.
Wow.
It was incredible.
That's an amazing scheme. And is it still running?
It is still running, yeah. And I often refer to Deloitte as my second parents. Mm-hmm. That scholar scheme was so formative to who I am, so much more so than university was. Mm. It was the most empowering year. I felt like I grew up in a corporate in that sense. Mm. That kind of year and a half mm-hmm. really shaped who I was and made me so comfortable in that environment.
It's amazing. And I guess they then really supported you then when you were there, for you to feel like they're a second parent.
Yeah, they financially supported us so well. And also, it actually felt like home. I didn't enjoy Cambridge that much, to be honest, because having worked and had my own identity and been staffed on projects, I felt really sure of who I was mm-hmm. when I was at Deloitte on that gap year. And then I went to Cambridge and I found it very infantilizing, actually. I think being out of the city and being in this thing that felt a bit like a machine in a way. I had a great academic education there, but I found it very isolating and quite lonely mm-hmm. during that time. So I would rush back to London during the holidays, you know, the summer holidays or Christmas holidays, to go and work on projects because I found that very life-affirming. Whereas mm-hmm. I found being at Cambridge, I didn't quite know who I was. I think academia is a discipline. Mm. You know, you can never quite know because you can always read more, and obviously you can write your own opinions and create a point of view, but you always know that there are other people who know a lot more than you. And it's always so much more complicated than you can ever grasp. Whereas I think the corporate world is a bit more scrappy and we'll go with this. And
yeah. And so then you left Cambridge after you did your master's.
Yes.
And went back to Deloitte for a bit.
Yes, I went back to Deloitte. The other thing that the scholar scheme actually gave me was a complete lack of fear of being fired. Because of that year at the age of 18, yeah. where I learned these core skills of presentation, PowerPoint, structuring information, storytelling, data, I knew then that I could add value to any organisation mm-hmm. that I would be in. And that has allowed me to take so many more risks, be much more honest in any environment or organisation that I've subsequently been in. Because I thought, well, if I get fired from my job tomorrow, I've got this incredible base skill set from Deloitte that I can always return to. And I think that's given me a kind of fearlessness or ability to be bold, especially in corporates, which has come to define, I think, a lot of what my signature work looks like.
That's amazing. What an amazing thing to have left with, and so lovely to have that notion of not coming out of uni, looking for a job, worried, thinking about how am I going to pay this, and just like accepting maybe not the right thing so that you can pay the bills. Like, that's awesome. What a great position.
Yeah, exactly. It was an amazing position to be in. And other, you know, the other things that were amazing about it is that because at that time I was only one scholar, aged 18, versus the grads who had come out of university. And because also I didn't have rent in the same way, and it was kind of slightly temporary, I also learned to talk to partners in a different way, because again, I was a bit fearless and naive, and kind of came to know that partners and senior people within organisation love being talk to normally and to hear about things and get insights from the ground that they become quite protected from when I think so many people have things to lose. Whereas because I was just out of school, I developed really great friendships. There's a couple of partners that I'm still in touch with who I call my second dads. I have such a fondness for them because they really broke down barriers. It really demystified leadership for me, I don't see seniority as a barrier to just having an honest conversation with people, because they're just people, right?
Yeah. That's so awesome. Do you know how many of the schemes they offer each year, like placements?
So when I joined, there were about 30 spaces a year across the UK, mm-hmm. and I think it continues to run. And I know that other big four do it as well. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just they also run similar schemes for people who don't want to go to university but want to go straight in. Mm. Found it absolutely incredible and has stood me in a really great stead. So, yeah, I think about Deloitte as the most formative part in my career and who I am, actually.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So going back to your role, what skills do you need to be a strategy and operations lead?
The number one skill, I think, to succeed in strategy and operations is actually empathy. And I say that because people are always at the end of strategy and the operations of it, right? Strategy dies if people don't listen to it or act differently based on it. And if you're somebody who invests in relationships and people to understand what their points of view are, what are the real blockers that are stopping things being done in a particular way, then you can create an amazing strategy that's based in the reality as opposed to something that does not in any way reflect how people are working on the ground. And I hate the idea of ivory tower strategists who are removed from all of that because, yeah, of course, it's easy to put things onto a slide and talk about how organisational structures should work. If you assume good intent and that people are always trying to do the best things through empathy and personal relationships within work, you can always get a richer insight and develop a better strategy as a result of it. So for me, the best strategy and operations professionals are people who are people first. They don't have to go and conduct interviews with people. They just have a chat with their buddies at the coffee machine to find out what's actually happening on the ground.
Is that a skill you learnt though? Or is that a skill you observed?
Oh.
And were like, that works better than the ivory tower?
That was definitely a skill that I observed through being on some projects where we were creating these incredible tools to help people do their jobs better. Mm-hmm. But we were literally sitting in a glass box doing that, a room with these glass windows, mm-hmm. and our clients would refer to us as the clever people in that room.
Yeah.
And of course, what happened is that no one used the tool. They continued using their spreadsheets that they'd bought with them from the first retailer that they'd ever been to as a buyer or merchandiser. And for me, I think that was the biggest early on learning, which was that you can create the most kick-ass technology, but if you don't have a really strong change program and communications program and really clear reason to believe for people to use that, then it's slightly pointless. Mm. And a big bugbear of mine within strategy and operations is that people think of communications as a tack-on. It comes at the end. Mm-hmm. Whereas actually the way in which you communicate, painting this positive vision of what the future looks like, is so important to getting people to do that change. But it's always considered last. It's referred to as kind of fluff. And for me, that's a massive gap.
Okay. And any other skills?
I think my bread and butter is probably structuring information in a way that helps people to process it. So 40% of the body's at rest calorific consumption is through what we see, which means it is exhausting for us to see information. Mm-hmm. And so as a strategy and operations person, being able to structure it and tell a story and pull out insights that are compelling and interesting and relevant is a core skill set, I think, as well. And prioritization within that, right? Making sure that you're showing people what's relevant to them as opposed to giving people information overload. I also have a point of view on where strategy and operations skill sets need to move as well, because especially when I'm thinking about internal strategy and landing internal change programs, before social media and people were just so constantly on different devices, there was probably greater mental availability to receive certain messages. Mm-hmm. But now, if I ask you to change the way that you report the number of pitches that you're doing a week, for example, the last thing that you've seen is probably a really cool piece of creative on Instagram or Facebook or whatever that is. Mm-hmm. So actually, I'm not competing with another initiative asking you to, you know, do some volunteering within the organisation or mentoring. I'm competing with people who've put loads of thought into how to get you to act on a piece of information. Mm-hmm. And so I think from an internal strategy, the bar has to be so much higher in terms of the quality of our visual communication, branding, messaging, for people to take action on that. Data, insights, storytelling are the core strategy and operations skills, in my opinion, but storytelling is the thing that makes change land or fail.
Mm. And that's linked with empathy, your first point, isn't it?
Yeah.
To be able to tell a story and to connect with someone comes back to empathy.
Yeah. It's not something that people traditionally associate, yeah. I think, with strategy and operations. No. It's all very much like spreadsheets and Excel. I love using the Marie Kondo approach to life, probably slightly too far. When I think about spreadsheets, for example, I think about, are people going to use this? And if so, how are they going to interact with it? And actually, how can we make it an enjoyable experience for them to go into something that's quite daunting? How can we break down the barriers? How do you make this as visually intuitive to use as possible so that people want to do it, as opposed to something that people are slightly afraid of anyway, mm-hmm. and then becoming really complicated? And again, I think that is the difference between kind of good and bad strategy and operations, is, you know, how user-centric you are in what you're designing.
So how do you become a good storyteller?
I take a lot of inspiration from B2C marketing. If I think about my role at Google as influencing people internally, mm-hmm. then I look outside of that world to best-in-class storytelling and then thinking about how I can unfold it. So something that Sam Conniff talks about in Be More Pirate is how the pirates weaponized storytelling. Mm-hmm. And before Coca-Cola's super brands of this world, the skull and crossbones was this universal symbol of surrender or die. Mm. And so there have been a couple of instances internally where we've wanted to drive a change program around customer centricity, the program I was telling you about earlier. And we've actually taken that approach by having a really clear visual brand. We pivoted away from talking about customer centricity, which doesn't mean that much, doesn't particularly spark joy. And we talked about customer love. And we launched it on Valentine's Day. We had a very clear aesthetic that ran through all of our communications for a year so that people knew that everything they were getting, whether it was how to have a more effective meeting or how to collaborate better internally, was all to do with us. And we lifted it up above all the noise, because the internal marketplace for messages is so crowded as well, right? Everyone wants people to do something differently. And it's all good and it's all important, but ultimately you're fighting for mental availability. So I guess taking some inspiration from the pirates and thinking about how to cut through the noise. Also, sometimes you need to be brutally honest and call bullshit, to be honest. And a lot of the work that I do in strategy and operations is stopping stuff, saying, actually, does this need to go to all these people? How can we be more focused in the people that it reaches so that we're not distracting everyone? Can I take this burden on instead of a team of 50 to protect them from it a little bit? So I haven't answered your question at all around what good storytelling is like, but my...
I don't know. I think you have. You've talked about stripping it out, making sure you target and focus, making it visual, thinking of the process, thinking of who's receiving it.
Yeah, actually, I do have a formula for this, mm-hmm. which I didn't really think about, but when I talk about landing change, the formula tends to be, or the people I take inspiration from is, how do you spark joy? Mm-hmm. So taking a bit of Marie Kondo. Yeah. Then how do you weaponize storytelling, pirate style? Mm-hmm. Then the third one is actually vulnerability, using Brené Brown's definition mm-hmm. of it, right? We talk mm-hmm. about vulnerability all the time and, you know, take risks. But actually, it's really uncomfortable to be brave. There are mm-hmm. some epic fails that I've done in trying to create a splash internally to create a change. And it's scary just before you launch something, mm-hmm. you know, just before you send something out into the world. It feels horrible. So I think that combination of, you know, joy, being pirate, and vulnerability would be my strange love child combination of best practice storytelling.
That is awesome. And I love that you talk about risk and fail. Like, vulnerability is one thing, and obviously taking risks can make you feel vulnerable, but also risk taking is really important for change, for creating something new. But that does include failure sometimes, and that's difficult to deal with. How did you deal with that when you had... You said epic. I'm not calling them epic, but when you had a failure.
So the specific example of failure that I'm talking about, to give a little bit more colour, is something that our senior leaders talk about all the time, is walking in customers' shoes. Mm-hmm. And as I said, sometimes you need to be a little bit tongue-in-cheek about things. And so I've never walked in somebody else's shoes, literally. And I don't know why that's an expression that we use all the time. Mm-hmm. And so we launched this campaign, which was around customer love, but it was socks today, mm-hmm. shoes tomorrow. And to reinforce this message and really try to break down what it meant to walk in somebody's shoes, we got a load of shoes, and in our main food and eating area, hung loads of shoes down from the kind of pipes and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it looked really cool, right? It was quite multidimensional, mm-hmm. but Hanging shoes means different things in different cultures, none of which point towards customer love, which is what we were trying to do. And
quite the opposite in some.
Quite the opposite in some. So it can, yeah. My knowledge of this, build on this if there's any other connotations that you know to be true. Yeah. A drug deal's going down, and or suicide.
And marking territory.
And marking territory. Mm. There we go. None of these things were what I wanted to be associated with my change program. And I was trying to do something different. My approach was, let's use every surface that we have available to us, because I think that change doesn't happen over email. Change dies over email. Bravery dies over email, because it's so easy to kill a precious fledgling idea. And so my ethos is always, the job starts at the point that you send the email. The job is not done at the point that you send the email. You can never assume that people have read that. And it's kind of the crutch that people use as a communication method for change internally. Mm. Which is why I then said, how do we innovate for the innovators? How can we think more like marketeers internally and create this kind of immersive program? I don't want anyone to come into our building without knowing that customer centricity and putting the customer first is our North Star. There were lots of bits that were successful, which some people liked, some people didn't like. And there was also this shoe thing. Actually, people took it in the spirit that it was meant, which was really nice. But actually, it was one of those things where at Friday night, when I was there, like, hanging things up, a couple of people walked past and were like, you know what that means? And I was like, oh, God. And was worrying about it all weekend.
Of course, yeah.
And actually, I think, you know, you asked earlier, what's a skill? I think there are a couple. One is knowing that you're never going to reach everybody and that people won't always receive that information in the same way. When we do things like desk drops, some people love it. They're like, yes, this is so great. This sparks right. Other people are like, can you get this shit off my desk? Mm-hmm. And actually remembering that people receive information and learn in such different ways, and actually making sure that whatever it is that you're trying to change has something for everyone in that process. And also that everyone will have a point of view on what you're doing. I think that kind of resilience and thick skin is something that I've developed over the last few years. And I never expected that that's what I'd be spending the majority of my time doing at Google. I thought I would be writing strategy papers and analysis. Mm-hmm. And actually, because it's such a large matrixed organization, thinking about how you get change to really land all the way down has been the thing that I've spent disproportionate and unexpected amount of my time doing.
You're making me so excited, just the way you talk about what you do. Like, it's so thoughtful and purposeful. Yeah, I love it.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I love it as well. It kind of, it's what gets me up in the morning.
Well, I can tell. And it's like, you're smiling when you're talking, which is making me smile.
Excellent.
So you've talked about data, technology, and storytelling, and that all kind of folds into marketing. Mm. Can you talk about a project that was being successful for you, which I'm sure there's many?
I think I would use the same example. The shoe example, you're right, it's not a failure. It's just an example of genuine vulnerability, and vulnerability feeling like you're at risk and emotional exposure and worrying that you're going to get fired because what if that got misinterpreted in a way or offended or whatever that might be? Yeah. So I think it's just showing that we can talk about vulnerability, but for me that was a really specific moment where I was trying to do something in a different way and the organisation was okay with it and it was fine, but you do have to take risks sometimes. It didn't feel nice. I wasn't like, oh, I feel so brave and risky. I was like, I might get fired this weekend.
Well, that must have been a horrible week.
It was a horrible weekend, but the great thing is that the managing director of Google UK, Ronan Harris, is customer centricity, and putting customer centricity at the heart of everything we do is his passion, and he not only talks about it, but he also walks that walk in every question that he asks. He's so thoughtful in the way that he does that. And there's this concept called, you know, the leader's shadow, that leaders cast this shadow, and there's nothing that creates more organizational stasis than when a leader says one thing and does something that's different. But actually he's so coherent in that. And so he backed me, and it was taken in the spirit that it was meant to, which was great. Yeah. And that's another bit that, you know, Be More Pirate talks about, which is you never get fired. It's actually the act of doing something different, the shocking the muscles in a little bit to do something different, and it generally it pays off. You get change from it, and change is good. In terms of a positive project, I think, yeah, I took on customer centricity as a project 2 years ago, and I did that because I wrote this point of view document to Ronan, our managing director. It was titled, What Got Us Here Won't Get Us There. And I said to him, look, if you want us to continue how we've done with these incremental changes you're on here, then you should carry on doing what you're doing. But if you want change, then you should put me on it and I will change the way that we do it. And he backed me because amazing. He's amazing. And what we did was we moved away from customer centricity being something that was just talked about at the points in the year where the survey was going out to customers, where it was quite kind of functional, to a kind of having an always on drumbeat so that people knew that customer centricity was actually the thing that we were focusing on and prioritising month in, month out. Mm. We pivoted away from customer centricity, which again doesn't spark joy, to customer love. We launched that on Valentine's Day. We did a big splash over people's desks. There was no surface untouched by the customer love initiative. Uh-huh. So we just re-energized it and we brought personality to it and thought about messaging it in a slightly different way and in a joyful way. And we just got our latest set of results in and they've gone up and to the right, which is good.
Awesome.
So I always am holding my breath sharply before the results come in. It's been good. And actually another core skill of strategy operations, especially in a company like Google, is influencing without authority. Marketing Academy taught me that the definition of leadership is when you have influence over somebody. Mm-hmm. And so actually I have influence over at least 500 people, and that's amazing. And so I will step up and act like a leader in that and not wait to be given direct line management. Mm. But what would I do if I was managing those people? How would I treat them?
Which is a lovely segue into your mentoring and coaching. So you do that with young people from disadvantaged backgrounds, and you talk about public speaking and presentation skills. So can you talk a little bit more about how you got involved, why you do it, what it gives you?
Yeah. So when I was at school, I was asked by my English teacher to recite William Wordsworth's Daffodils. Mm. And you know the old school Victorian desks with the lid?
Yeah.
And I literally put my head inside the desk because I so badly did not want to recite this poem in front of the class. And my mum, who is...
I should say, though, you're very young, and I'm very surprised you had a Victorian school desk. People thinking, is she 80 years old?
It's just a very old school. Yeah. I was so terrified at standing up and doing this, and my mum said that I should get involved in debating and go to some debating classes. And debating changed my life. I've said that a couple of times. Not that many things changed my life. Mm. Deloitte was really pivotal in being... forming who I am, but debating gave me a confidence to be able to stand up and argue absolutely anything with confidence, and that was around structuring an argument, speaking clearly, sounding confident even if I was absolutely terrified inside, which I frequently am, and articulating myself clearly. And I look back upon that as being such a critical success factor in me succeeding in the workplace and even at university, and being forced to do things like you have 5 minutes to prepare a 5-minute speech on why the sky is yellow or whatever that might be. Mm-hmm. Just gives you such a confidence to think on your feet and an ability to argue whatever it is and present information that way. Anyway, the reason I say that is because that was so transformative for me in terms of how I carried myself, feeling confident. And when I was at Deloitte, I worked a lot on something called the Employability Initiative, where we went to schools with kids from, as I said, disadvantaged backgrounds and did sessions on writing their CV skills, presentation skills, and interview skills. And I would spend hours with people who actually weren't that much younger than I was, getting them to walk in and out of the classroom to shake my hand. Mm-hmm. And that's all we would focus on for, say, a 2-hour period. What you think about yourself to be able to look somebody else in the eye, what your handshake says about you, whether you're going for an interview at Greg's or at Deloitte or to university, wherever that is, it's everything you do leaks so much information about you. And I think before I even recognised it, that's the beginning of a core belief that I have, which is just work as hard as you can to know how you want to show up and then be so intentional about every touch point you have, whether that be how you walk into a room, what you wear, the language that you use, the eye contact you make. Mm-hmm. And I believe that anybody with an hour of time on the basics of eye contact, handshaking, tone, body language could go in and transform their interview skills from 0 to 100 just through a few modifications. And I think it's so powerful to unlocking people's potential, whatever it is that they want to do, because it's just about influencing. It's just about how you get people to have confidence in you as a person. So I really believe in the power of those small micro things in changing the outcomes of how, whether people succeed or fail in what they want to do.
My next question is that I know, and only briefly, because we bumped into each other at Gather, and then I got swept up in loads of people coming to chat to me after, and then we didn't get a chance to really chat again, but you did tell me you were writing a book.
Yes.
So can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yes, I would love to, partially because then it creates some more accountability. I'm writing a book called How to Lean In When You're Not the COO of Facebook. So I just start by saying that I love Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg. I know a lot of people don't like it, but for me it was an incredibly powerful book. It made me think about things in a completely different way. As I've progressed, there are things that I wish I'd have known, which aren't quite covered in that book. It's slightly out of reach for, say, somebody in the first 0 to 7 years of their career who don't have an assistant, for example, who don't have a team, who are just trying to, I don't know, like iron their blouse in time to get to work and not, you know those basic things. I think that surviving the workplace in the first few years can feel really harrowing. And I want to write a book which anyone can really wear as a superpower cloak on how to turn up and how to survive in those first few years. Because I don't think it's easy, and there are loads of things I wish I'd have known earlier that I think would have transformed that experience. A couple of examples one is around helpfulness, particularly for girls. I think at school and from a societal perspective, girls are told to be helpful and diligent and conscientious. And I think that that can, in some situations, work against you by undermining the reason why you're in that room. So a specific example is, if I think back to consulting days, I would frequently set my alarm for 4 a.m. in the morning and be the person in, like, printing the things for a workshop, setting it up, you know, making sure that everyone had, like, the coffee that they wanted. And you know, I'd be going so above and beyond to be helpful, but I think about how I probably could have pulled back from that or spent my time doing something slightly different to add value. But actually, I had to go through that period of, like, unlearning helpfulness, you know, not being the person who puts their hands up as soon as a partner would say, would somebody take notes? Because often it's the woman rather than the man. And so, again, this isn't about not being authentic and not being helpful, but it's just being very cognizant of what role are you playing in that room, and is the activity that you're doing supporting that? Are you there as the strategy and operations lead? And if so, is the most valuable use of your time to be taking notes, for example? And I just wish I'd have been a little bit more thoughtful about that, because I think I probably, in trying to be very helpful, undermined myself when combined with, you know, looking young, being a female, not being white. I think all of those things probably meant that I had to work above and beyond to be taken seriously and have gravitas as potentially a male counterpart at the same point, who would pitch up 10 minutes before the workshop, say a couple of interesting things, and then not also be responsible for the write-up at the end of the workshop.
So I'm loving this book. So when's it coming out?
That is a good question. Well, maybe you should ask me that question every week for the next few weeks. So my goal is, I'm turning 30 in December, and I would like to have it written by the end of this year. I don't know anything about publishing. No. I don't even know whether... All I know is that when I tell people about it, they say, I wish I'd have read that book, or that sounds so useful.
Yeah.
And really all it is about intentionality. And I think I just didn't ask myself a lot of those questions around how do you want to show up. I didn't think that those were important questions.
But they are part of the journey as well, aren't
they?
Yes. But if someone can give you a bit of insight beforehand, that's awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's needed.
So, yes, it's needed.
So you're going to do it before your birthday?
I'm going to do it before my birthday.
I reckon October.
Okay, good. I'm happy to be held to account on that. Yes, I'm going to structure it. I had a great conversation with Christine Armstrong, who wrote a book called The Mother of All Jobs, which is a brilliant book.
Okay.
And anyway, we had a bit of a breakthrough in that I think I have a little bit of imposter syndrome about writing this book, because part of me is like, yeah, when I hear your introduction, I'm like, yeah, you know what? I have done well. Like, maybe I do have something useful to say about these things. Then the other voice inside my head is, well, there are so many brilliant women doing these great things. Like, why should anyone listen to what I have to say? And so I think I was getting in a bit of a rut around, well, I don't want this to be, you know, Crystal's view on the world and how to be successful, because I don't think I have that formula cracked. But instead, I'm going to structure it around mistakes or fuck-ups that I made along the way and, you know, how I wish I'd have reacted differently or thought differently about those things. And hopefully in doing that, maybe it's helpful to somebody.
I think that is helpful. But you know what I also find really helpful is hearing about the successes.
Yeah.
Because then I'm like, that is such an ingenious idea. If I just pivoted, if I just thought about it this way.
Yeah.
So whilst fuck-ups are good to learn from,
yeah,
I also want to learn from people's successes. Like, yeah. I love that. And I'm so in awe. So maybe a balance.
Yes.
Because you've had many successes.
Yeah.
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 But it is a journey. Yeah. Can't be too hard on ourselves.
It is a journey. And I think actually a lot of it is just saying that, yeah, I think that the reticence I have or like nervousness I have about it is like none of this is about being contrived. Mm-hmm. It's just about working harder earlier on about who you are and then kind of really going all guns blazing behind that, as opposed to here is a set of activities that I think are going to create a certain impression about you. I think it is just about authenticity, getting closer to your values sooner.
Well, I can't wait to read this book. So apart from writing the book, what has been one of the biggest challenges you faced in your career?
There have been a few micro moments, but I actually think the thing that stands out to me and I find the hardest is actually the exhaustion that comes with being considered a difficult woman or trying to push things forward, right? So the number of times that I've been told, you just want to move faster than the system will allow. And that absolutely enrages me. Nothing makes me more furious than being told, well, you just need to wait your turn. The system isn't really built for people like you. Well, fucking break it then, you know? That makes me so frustrated. And I think consistently being in environments where I have felt that having that conversation about salary, going for that stretch opportunity, you know, I've heard all these data points. I'm now going to apply for the jobs when I'm meet, you know, 40% of the criteria like men do. I'm going to ask for the pay rise. I'm going to ask those difficult questions. It doesn't feel good. It feels really exhausting. So rather than like a specific moment where something happened, I think it's just along the whole way, there's just a cumulative exhaustion and kind of that feeling sometimes where you're like, maybe I am just difficult. Maybe I'm a difficult person. Quite recently, I had a moment of like that total self-doubt where, you know, I think organizations can make you feel like you're really asking for the world when it's really quite a simple thing. And you go through this cycle of thinking where you're like, should I just be a bit more diminutive? Should I just toe the line? Should I not ask? Should I not put my hand up? And so that's something that every now and again, I kind of get swept up in. And then I have wonderful friends who remind me that they are the reason why I've got to the place where I am now and to keep doing that. But it's exhausting. I think that's the biggest challenge, is like keeping the faith. Because as you can probably hear, there is also that inside voice, which is a bit like, well, are you even that good? Should you be asking for those things? Should you go for those opportunities?
It is when people keep saying, not yet, no, the system's not ready for you. You are going to question yourself.
Yeah.
But what I love is because you are so thoughtful and so emotionally intelligent that you're paving the way to start pushing that aside going forward. You know, you're kind of paving a bit of a path there, because we all hear those voices, but you seem to keep doing it. And it is exhausting. It's constantly exhausting, self-checking.
Yeah.
Self-analyzing.
Yeah.
Fighting the critical voice that comes as a result of the culture.
Not only is it convincing yourself that you're as good as the opportunity that you're going for, then you're convincing the organization. And then in my case, it's also typically being very other in a particular environment, whether that be being a female, being under a certain age, being non-white. There are all those things that I think psychologically just require a lot of energy, because I feel myself kind of expanding to fill the space that I should do, but it's, you know, when you go home at the end of the day, it feels exhausting.
And it is exhausting, and I think there is that, and it's learning how to, for me, recoup from that.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so what do you love about your job?
So I love my job because it's fundamentally about how well you understand people and then how well you can create a strategy and a kind of operating model that really suits the needs of those people and gets them to where they want to go to, not only as employees, but also as human beings. And I think that's a fascinating challenge. The reason I most love my current job is I describe as the airport lounge test. So when I see anybody in an airport lounge with a kind of Google badge or a sticker, I'd actively go out of my way to go and chat to them and say, oh, you work for Google, which office are you from, what do you do? I know that we'd have like a brilliant, brilliant conversation. I wouldn't just say that is true of other places that I've been. And so universally, the best thing about being there is the people, because there's not a homogeneity to a Googler, but there's a kind of passion and a conviviality that I find really energizing.
So can you tell me maybe what's the best bit of advice you've received in your career?
The best piece of advice I have received was actually whilst on a coaching session as part of the Marketing Academy program, which I have to give a big shout out to. Everyone and anyone should apply for it. It's incredible. And what Emma said to me was, lead with kindness, not competence. And at the time, it didn't sink in as much as it did in the subsequent weeks and months. And now I think of it as kind of the most liberating piece of advice I got. Sometimes it's easier to go into the corporate robot persona where you're, you know, a safe pair of hands and very competent. And yes, I can get this done. And I'm the consultant. I'm the brains here. And actually flipping to leading with kindness really gets you so much further than just being the person who's always right. You know, it's better to be wise than right. And I also believe that. Emma Harris is the coach. And she said, you know, you actually have a really great personality, but when I first met you, you come across as far, like, really well put together and, you know, corporate and very articulate. I don't really know who that is. But once I get to know you, I know that you're actually not like that. And you should let that show a little bit. You should relax into yourself. And so I think that's been the most powerful, because it's been quite liberating. It meant that I can get to me quicker rather than having this, I think I used to put up barriers and almost lead with competence. And how do I prove to you that I'm great before actually, and making it harder for people to like you and to trust you. So actually now I just try and be myself from the beginning and make terrible dad jokes, and then, you know, people can take me as I am or not.
So how do you fuel your creativity? What do you do? Where do you go? What do you see?
A few different things. First of all, I do a lot of Bikram yoga. So I spend 90 minutes in a very hot room sweating. And the reason I do this is because I go into this kind of trance-like state, which for me is my brain's alpha frequency mode, where I'm not actively thinking about any of those things, but a lot of ideas will come to me because I have this kind of soft focus on nothing. You know, you're looking at yourself in a mirror, but I don't see myself. My brain is somewhere else. So I find that really important silent time that allows my brain to process in a kind of non-pressurized way. So even though I'm not working, I feel like my subconscious is relaxing and working really hard in that environment. And I think Bikram yoga is amazing because it's for me, the epitome of a growth mindset. Some days you'll go in and you'll feel on top of the world and you'll be able to do every position perfectly and you'll just feel like an absolute boss. And then another day you'll go in having eaten really healthily and drunk loads of water and you will just be struggling to stay in the room, and it's very humbling to do that. And another day you'll have a teacher that you haven't had before and you'll hear an instruction in a different way and you'll make a tiny modification and it will completely change the way that you move into that posture. And then another day you'll have a terrible hangover and you'll absolutely smash it, and you just realize that it's practice, it's not perfection, and it teaches me a lot of lessons around coping with things. I think if you can be, you know, semi upside down in a 40 degree hot box, then you can deal with most stressful things in life. So second thing is actually Radio 4. I love everything on Radio 4, apart from Gardener's Question Time. I'm sure there'll be a point at which I love that. But I love that you can turn it on and hear a perspective. You know, like I love the Social Listening Project, for example, and Women's Hour. And all of that stuff feeds into the way I think about strategy and operations so deeply, because every insight that you collect is going to be representative of somebody's view in that business who's, you know, behavior you're trying to change. So I kind of collect that information. I even listen to the same things twice because, you know, you can't turn it on and not learn something. And I just, I wish, actually say to my friends a lot that I wish I could like pay a subscription just to Radio 4 because of the value that I get from them, from them so much. And maybe that should be our next ambition, to be the co-hosts of Women's Hour.
That would be great. Wouldn't that be awesome?
That would be incredible. And then the third one is actually a bit silly, but is genuine, is actually spending time with my dad. So my dad's called Wally. He is a builder. He's retired now. He's from Manchester. He's like, all he needs in life to be happy is to kind of go fishing and know that, you know, I'm alive and safe. And he has such a different perspective on the world, but he doesn't really get the, you know, my job and what I do particularly. But actually speaking to him, going fishing with him, fun fact for you, National Lady Sea Fishing Champion.
No.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
There aren't that many female sea fishing champions.
Yeah, but you're the top.
But I love spending time with my dad because he will make me think about things in a different way. So I think all of those things actually, apart from Bikram, are really around getting exposure to perspectives I don't usually get. But I also am like very basic, like, you know, on a Friday, another thing that I love to do is, you know, ordered 10 chicken wings from Nando's and like sit and watch it in front of Love Island. So it's not all kind of like cultural immersion. Like I can also be a very basic human being as well.
Well, Love Island is a culture of sorts.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not a fan. Patrick is a fan.
I feel like this is a big confession. I am a fan of Love Island and I'm okay with that. All of my titles subsequently stripped away from me.
Not at all. I think, well, it's definitely a social commentary.
Yeah.
And that's actually very important to your role as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Just as much as Radio 4 is.
Exactly. Yeah. But also I think for me that it fills a more functional purpose as well, which is again that kind of third brain space where you're not, weirdly, maybe Bikram and Love Island have many similar things other than people being like half naked most of the time. But, you know, it allows your brain to go into this space where you can process without focusing on something.
Yeah.
And reading is probably my number one creativity. It's my ultimate escapism. I devour books. It's probably the thing I spend most money on, and it brings me so much joy, and a combination of fiction and non-fiction, but... Yeah.
Amazing. I just want to say one thing, because I know you just mentioned your father, who sounds awesome.
Yeah.
But you mentioned your mum twice earlier on. Your mum encouraged you to go to talk to the woman who worked for Deloitte.
Yes.
And she also encouraged you to go on the debating team.
She did.
And those two things, you said, have changed your life.
That's
so
true.
I just want to give a big shout out to your mum.
Yes.
Because I just think that's awesome.
I should give lots of credit to Mina. She's the driving force behind everything that I do, because her and my dad worked really hard to put me through a great education. It was lots of double, triple shifts at the airport. And, you know, my dad very willingly, but, you know, he's a builder. He's got really bad arthritis in his legs now from all those, like, you know, kneeling down under sinks, all that thing. And same with my mum, you know, she worked so hard to give us that education that would set us up for life and allow us to achieve. And I think my constant goal, or when people say what drives you, I say it's actually just that I want to be a good return on investment for my parents, because I can't give them back the time that they invested, or the late nights, or the exhaustion, or the arthritis. I can't undo any of that, but I'm going to make damn sure that they know how much I value every, you know, late shift and every extra hour that they worked to you know, struggle to pay the bills, because it was difficult. So I feel so lucky that my mum in particular put such a primacy on our education and giving us that start in life. And she's an incredible woman.
I am feeling a bit teary. So Mina and Wally, that's so cool.
Mina and Wally,
that's amazing.
They're incredible.
I have so loved talking to you. No, I'm just about to cry, but also my cheeks are aching from sobbing so much. I am so looking forward to your book. I am so looking forward to, in the future, hopefully not too long, that we're both hosting Women's Hour. That would be awesome.
Yes.
But until that time, what have you got coming up in the next couple of weeks or months?
I'm really hesitant to say that I'm getting married because I don't want it to define who I am.
I wondered if you're going to say that.
Yeah, so I am getting married, but that is not the only thing that is defining my upcoming weeks. I'm very much looking forward to spending time with my husband. Mm-hmm. And spending time, you know, writing. There are a few articles that have bubbled up in my head. Weirdly, when I do yoga for those 90 minutes, I write articles in my head and create these great titles. And then a big feeling that I have is a feeling of being a fraud, because I have the book in my head and these articles and things that I want to say to the world, and they're not coming out, they're just in my head. And for me, the next weeks and months, up until my 30th birthday, are really about getting these words on paper and out of my brain. I think I'll find that a really amazing process.
Yeah, like I said, I so love talking to you. And before you go, I'm going to ask you something I ask everyone. Is there a career job in the creative industries that you know little about, and potentially I could get someone on the podcast to talk about that role? And also, is there a woman that you would nominate or recommend that I get in touch with to come on Greater Than 1%?
Well, I actually thought about that last question. And my answer is, I think as Patricia Mann winner, producer, podcaster extraordinaire, I think we should get you on the podcast to answer your own questions. So if I could hear more from an incredible woman, then I would love to hear you on your own podcast, please. And in terms of somebody in the creative industry, I'd actually, let's go high and let's try and get, you know, Jane Garvey in. Let's try and get one of the presenters of Women's Hour in.
That would be awesome.
To hear more about them. Or Fiona... what's her name? Social listening program woman.
Fee Glover.
Yes. Or let's aim for someone like Fee Glover to hear about what it's like to be on the inside of the social listening project. Actually, one thing we haven't mentioned is that my actual degree at university was social anthropology, and archaeology is what I started to go in for. I think that probably was the foundational intrigue around people, and that everyone has an interesting story to tell. A piece of advice that I heard recently was, if you give people enough space, everyone can be amazing. And so I love that idea that you give people the space and time and they can be amazing and feel that and tell their story. I find it an energizing thought.
Well, speaking of energizing, you've completely energized me. I had such a knackering day. I'm like so bubbling up with energy. So thank you so much, Crystal, for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here, and I'm obsessed with your podcast. It gives value to me every day.
Thank you so much. This podcast is made possible by The Sport of Hub, an insight-led content agency based in London. A huge thank you to the producers, Pat Murray and James Haverson, our editors, Daniel Clark and Laura Francis, and to Maria Contenenza for designing the beautiful artwork.